Welcome to another episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In, being recorded on March the 27th, 2024. I'm your host, Robert Swarthout, and I'll be joined with my co-host, Andres Sandate. How's it going, Andres?
Good. Hey, Robert. Really beautiful day here in Atlanta.
Yeah, it's we had a rainy day. Was it yesterday or the day before? But, you know, it's definitely starting to feel like springtime around here. Things are yellow. So
absolutely,
all of our pollen. Yes. For those that haven't experienced a spring in the South, it's something different. Yeah, everything turns bright yellow. And it makes your nose itch. So awesome. Well, maybe we'll just go ahead and jump in here. So yeah, we have our topics for today. We're going to kind of go over our Bitcoin ETFs, some Bitcoin exposure. That's kind of interesting, kind of see what's going to happen there. A couple case updates and Fidelity updating their ETH application. So why don't we just go ahead and start off with the Bitcoin ETFs, continue to set records. It's pretty, as someone that has never truly followed ETFs launching, I've been so fascinated by this. It's been something that, you know, admittedly has been setting records. So I think it's surprising a lot of people, even those in the industry. But it's a, it seems like every day there's a new record.
We were talking about how it's the all-time record for consecutive days of net positive inflows. Is it over 150 days?
It's 160 days set by JEPI. Not quite sure what that ETF is, but that was some time ago, I believe.
So it's a third of the way there, effectively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's really, I think one of the things about all these new records is, number one, just how quickly the size of inflows has gotten over 10 billion in the case of, you know, BlackRock's, but also it does feel from people that I know we both have spoken to, financial advisors are starting to take notice and starting to consider allocations or even begin to put the Bitcoin ETFs into portfolios.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think the 50th day that they set, and that's from the get-go. This has never happened out of the gate for any ETFs. I'm looking at a chart here of the current longest streaks. Obviously, the Fidelity and the iShares are leading at 50, but there's VGIT is currently on a 44-day streak, and then it quickly falls off to 8. Like, it's just, you know, trying to put it in perspective of how, I guess, special in a sense, what is happening here.
Yeah. I want to ask you before we move to the second topic, with respect to these ETFs, as somebody who is doing, you know, taking a different approach to investing in digital assets than just buying the ETFs, what are some of the early implications for you when you look at just the inflows?
You know, crypto is in many, you know, different viewpoints follows a very similar pattern or cycle within a bull market and bear market for that matter. And everyone's got these models, right? And we've, I think, talked about this a couple of weeks ago briefly, but like all the models are based upon how it went in the past. None of them had ETF inflows in them. And like, especially at the magnitude that they're happening, you know, just trying to, I guess, take a grain of salt, you know, how is it affecting it? Or is it affecting the models of the past? And, you know, I think that it's certainly given Bitcoin a huge advantage over the rest of the market. Not that it's really compared in that way, but, you know, there's easy access to Bitcoin and there's not easy access to the rest of them for all intents and purposes. And just like, as another ETF comes online, will it be the Ethereum one next or will it be something else for a different reason? Like, will there be a rotation from the Bitcoin or part of a rotation from the Bitcoin one into that so you get some diversity potentially? You know, how does that affect those assets? Like, it's a uncharted territory in many senses. So I find it fascinating. And, you know, my fund doesn't hold Bitcoin. So it doesn't truly affect me, but it definitely affects everything around me.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is just the with the inflows continuing to be positive on a daily basis. The other thing is you wonder, are more investors adding to their exposure or is this new dollars that are coming in for the very first time? And we talked about last time, just that a lot of Bitcoin holders have never been through a halving, which is going to happen next month. And also, we spoke this week, the volatility in crypto and particularly in Bitcoin is significantly more than, say, in a large cap stock, with the exception of those that, you know, have surprise announcements. But that's another thing that's happened over the last week or two. Just
yeah, you know, price action. My gut, I've not seen data that backs this up, but my gut tells me is it's continuing to be new interest. It's not people adding to a position. Maybe certainly there's people like maybe stepping into the market. I get that. But I think at a greater view of the market of the ETF volume, you know, you have the people rotating potentially out of the GBDC, potentially into a different another ETF. So you have some inflows there, but also more so just people that are interested. You know, I saw today that PNC is literally about to turn it on for their brokers to be able to sell it to their clients. And that's a huge wealth. I mean, like,
yeah, that's a big announcement. I mean, PNC is one of the 10 largest banks and has a, you know, big, obviously private bank, private wealth. So that's interesting.
Yeah. So maybe we'll kind of move on to number two here. So, you know, on the similar topic, you know, there's obviously you can be buying the Bitcoin ETF and you're getting Bitcoin within that, or you can go buy spot Bitcoin on, say, Coinbase or something like that. You know, the amount of exposure that hedge funds in particular have to Bitcoin right now has never been at a greater distance between the longs and the shorts. The volume is through the roof. And it almost feels like something's got to break. Like one of these sides has got to give.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at this chart that I have up here, it's almost mirrored. Like it's just gone vertical for the longs and basically hit the floor for the shorts, away from each other, I guess, away from that x-axis. So, you know, is a short squeeze coming, or is, you know, who's going to win? Time will tell. That does the halving play into it? You know, anybody's guess is as good as anyone else's at this point. But just another interesting thing that I had ran across yesterday.
Yeah, you know, you are approaching and actively investing in the digital asset space, perhaps differently than a lot of the folks that are just buying, clearly just a single token through buying Bitcoin ETFs. When you go about like your research process, are you starting to see more tools from a research standpoint and more information for like the professional crypto investor when you I know you didn't run a fund before, but I'm curious like what you're noticing.
Yeah, you know, I can't say that I've noticed tons. I've been on some calls recently with some prime brokers and they're offering up their research pieces, which I guess that's more of a traditional way of doing it. That's not how I go about my research.
Mm-hmm.
I've never actually asked to see a report. I should actually just read one to see what's in them. From the standpoint of like what others are finding interesting, In some sense, I kind of don't want to be biased either and kind of be fed information. I'd rather have it find me or seek it out personally. So,
yeah. Well, speaking of seeking out personally, one last point on the second topic about institutional and you mentioned PNC approving the ETFs on their platform. I think we were talking about this earlier. One of the larger crypto conferences that happens every year is put on by Consensus. And this is the first year, at least that I've noticed since I've been following the space, that they're literally providing access to financial advisors and RIAs or wealth managers like free to attend the conference. So they come to a day of content, presumably to learn more about the space and then have access to the whole conference. This is definitely a push by this industry to try to get in front of these influencers and gatekeepers.
Yeah, you know, we were there last year. It would have not been a place that you would have thought you found a single one of those type advisors there. So I don't know if they're keeping them in a separate room or if they're getting in a mix in the normal crowd, but it's cool to see the evolution because that's important at the end of the day. And, you know, education for that crowd, you know, I know that there's something called DAC FP. It's basically directed at the financial professional trying to teach them about crypto. It's, you know, it hopes to probably get you a mile wide and an inch deep. And then you can kind of explore areas that you think are more relevant to what you need to know.
So. Yeah. Well, I know this third point is one, Robert, that you've spent a fair amount of time following. What's the latest on the case between SEC and Ripple?
Yeah, so the case largely wrapped up last summer, in July the 13th. And at this point, we're in the remedies portion, basically negotiating between the defendant and the plaintiff what penalties or lack thereof should happen. We knew this was coming as an industry, but for the most part, the average XRP holder kind of doesn't care about this. But it is something of its interest. So the SEC finally filed their documents, effectively requesting $2 billion. B, that's like a B with a boy in the end. Mm-hmm. And this is unprecedented. Like, you go back and you look at the financial crisis, there wasn't even $1 billion worth of penalties across all of those different banks and, you know, people that got into quote unquote trouble.
Sure.
To see that the SEC thinks that Ripple needs to pay $2 billion. And granted, this is negotiation. So obviously they're going to be like, we want everything.
Right.
Even though they lost the majority of the case already.
Yeah.
So the $2 billion breaks down to a request for roughly $900 million in disgorgement and then roughly $200 million in prejudgment interest up on the disgorgement request and another $900 million in penalties. It just blows my mind. Like, my hunch is the SEC gets, at least from the penalties portion, they get less than $100 million. Because the vast majority of, if you break down where Ripple sold XRP to institutional clients, if you break it down, I think 80-something percent was done outside the U.S. It's not even in with the jurisdiction of the SEC. And then you couple that with, and Ripple said this publicly, that for disgorgement to actually be a thing, the SEC recently lost on this in court. For disgorgement to be a thing, the other party had to have lost money. Well, none of the parties have lost money on the XRP that they bought from Ripple. So, like, what are we talking about here? Like, does the disgorgement go away? Then does the interest go away? And are we left with just some kind of penalty? That's what I think happens, but it's nowhere close to $2 billion. My guess is it's less than $250 million, probably closer to $100 million. Just kind of guessing there, but just it feels more of a gut that is correct in that sense. So.
Yeah, you're almost like an arbitrage investor with this one. I know that's not the strategy, but trying to sort of if you were like trying to predict the outcomes of a court case and how it's going to get settled, but ultimately, in most cases there's a settlement, mm-hmm. and this is sort of like you said, the opening salvo. So it seems like they went for a big headline number.
Yeah,
being the SEC.
Yeah, they being the SEC, and then Ripple has 30 days to do their reply. Brett Darlinghouse and Stuart Eldorati, the chief legal counsel of Ripple, have publicly said on Twitter, like, they look forward to, having their voice be heard in the front of the court, and they look for a fair judgment and all the things. You know, all the things that they should be saying is what they're saying. At the end of the day, I think if the SEC wins on a lot of this stuff, it's in my opinion, not necessarily it's certainly they want to beat Ripple because Ripple beat them in any other portion of the case. But they want to scare a lot of other people within the industry to kind of like get in line and don't test this.
Yeah.
And Ripple is taking the opposite tack. It's like, oh, we're going to test you and we're going to beat you. Has been their strategy. So
yeah. Before we move on to Fidelity and the update to their ETH application, I'm curious when people hear the SEC is suing Ripple, that's the company, yeah. Ripple the company, but the token that Ripple, I guess, issues is different. It's a token called XRP, and the whole case stemmed from whether or not that was a security or not.
Yeah, so I'll correct one small thing. They don't issue it, but they are the biggest...
They're the biggest owner.
The biggest owner and also the biggest proponent of trying to get its use case out there.
Yeah.
It's... What Ripple does with XRP and doesn't do with XRP does affect the market. Mm-hmm. The SEC would like to think that it's 100% of the time. There's certainly other projects and companies outside of that are trying to use XRP or, use it in some way. It's been a long journey as an XRP holder, depending on when you bought in. But at the end of the day, it's one of the projects that they're trying to solve a problem that is so entrenched. They're trying to replumb the financial system from a banking payments / cross-border payments perspective. I'm not quite sure they could have chosen anything more difficult to go after out of the gate instead of trying to have smaller cases. So you know, hindsight's 2020, would they have done something different? I don't know. But I look forward to the case being behind at least Ripple. Does that mean the SEC doesn't go after somebody else? You know, who knows? Yeah. I mean, they're kind of going after Ethereum a little bit right now. It's not really publicly a case yet, but they're certainly investigating. And that's unfortunate. We just need Congress to do their job and kind of clean this mess up.
Yeah, provide a little bit more clarity, because uncertainty in this market and a lack of regulation is certainly keeping a lot of institutions and a lot of investors sort of on the sidelines. Well, we mentioned Ethereum. Let's talk about Fidelity. And when you put in here the news that Fidelity's updated their application, maybe we could step back and just talk about the process of registering an ETF, because it's an ongoing dialogue with the SEC, effectively.
Right. So it's the way that I understand it. There's multiple pieces or multiple entities that get involved. There's the sponsor. There's the authorized participant, I think is what it, AP. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's even two of the other pieces that I don't remember the correct description of. But at the end of the day, a group of people come together, they file an application. I believe it's an S-1 still. And the S-1 kind of lays out, this is what we're selling, this is what we're doing, this is, you know, how we're going to custody it if it's a digital asset, and all those different pieces. Again, like I said up front, I've never followed an ETF process before. I followed this Bitcoin one, and it's been fascinating to kind of learn. It's not as simple as it seems on the surface, you know.
No.
BlackRock says they have an ETF. BlackRock's not really even holding the crypto. They have a custodian. They have someone else that's managing buying the crypto. Like, I don't know if it's the most efficient process, but it's definitely the process that we have in place now.
That's right. Yeah. These products, all these registered products, which, you know, ETFs and other exchange trade products, registered funds, mutual funds, et cetera, they all fall under a regime that the SEC has outlined. And so there's all these processes and steps, which does provide, I guess you could say, belt and suspenders for the retail investor, the individual investor, but it does in the application process allow for the issuer sponsor to take comments from the SEC's lawyers, and then in this case, modify the application. What was the modification that they made this week? And speaking of Fidelity.
Yep. So I don't think I've mentioned it on this particular podcast before, but on another podcast that I record, you know, we've talked about how the Bitcoin ETF is very cut and dry. You either own or you don't. There's nothing else. There's no cash flow. There's nothing else to go along with it. Ethereum is, and anything that would come along that's going to be ETF that is proof of stake, there's, you can think of it as cash flow. I mean, there's the, or like an interest type reward by holding. That's the rewards of being part of the system and literally staking your claim. You know, so they updated the application to talk around the proof of stake piece of that and kind of how those rewards are going to be, you know, dealt with. You know, I think that this adds another dimension to it, right? Like the Bitcoin one, everyone was fighting over fees, you know, like who can, is basically a race to zero. The Ethereum one could be similar in the fee perspective, but also then you kind of have in this other, this cash flow perspective where, you know, an ETF provider would be like, oh, we're going to return 80% and, you know, we're going to return 81%. Like they could kind of split it. And it's not always the same cash flow because the market or the network can fluctuate some. So, which I guess does complicate maybe some of the disclosures that they would have to do, but it's a, I'm glad that this finally came out, because when I was talking about an ETH Ethereum one coming soon, I'm like, what are they going to do about this proof of stake? Like this matters almost more than anything else that the Bitcoin one dealt with, because it's going to have, there's far more tokens out there like that.
Yeah. I want to ask you with respect to the yield, we saw this movie before with crypto several years ago. There were a number of, I guess you'd call them issuers and investors who were pursuing a yield farming strategy. And you saw a lot of retail investors in particular.
The DeFi, you know, summer of 2021.
Right. 2021, right? 3 years ago. I want to say lured in, because that sounds nefarious, but attracted to the space because of these really high yields, which it turns out were
four digit, like insane yields. Yes.
Yeah. Could you just give a quick review? Because I think there's a lot of folks in crypto today that were not in crypto 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. They were not in these yield farming strategies. And a lot of those sponsors or managers are not around anymore, or they pivoted their strategies. But what happened at a high level from your take? Like, if you went back and looked and saw the history,
people were blinded. Like, that's the easy answer. People were, it was definitely a casino, just like cryptos today, but a different game that they were playing then. A lot of times you were taking and you were putting maybe one or two different tokens into a pool, and then you were getting a return on that because that was getting lent out the other side. The returns or the yields were so high, two digits, certainly 3-digit percent returns, some even crazy, like 4-digit, like 1,000% return type situation. Like, anybody with a straight mind would have been like, this makes no sense. Don't get in it. And people were. And what happened is a lot of people got left holding the bag because all of a sudden those yields came down very quickly and crashed. And you got left holding less assets than you put into the pool because guess what? There was, in some sense, were used to pay the rewards. I'm glad that that's behind us. That there was, I didn't get involved in it. I kind of sat and watched it. I'm like, am I the idiot for not playing this game? Like, it was that tempting. But at the end of the day, if something's too good to be true, likely is.
Okay. Let's talk about the SEC and the Coinbase case.
Yeah. So this case was filed, I think, last fall, late summer, early fall. The SEC is suing Coinbase for not being a broker dealer like the SEC thinks they should be. And, all the things, the SEC's got their hammer, their securities hammer, and they're swinging it around. There was different parts of this. Early on in the first briefing, it seemed like, man, Coinbase is really ahead of the curve. They kind of took a book out of Ripple's playbook when they were fighting them. The industry is slowly learning how to fight the industry. The industry is slowly learning how to fight the SEC.
And the regulators.
Yeah. And the Coinbase part is interesting because there was, I think, 5 or 6 different counts that they were like fighting over. One of them was the idea that Coinbase has what they call a Coinbase wallet. It's an iPhone, Android app. Allows you to interact with Ethereum and a couple other blockchains. And at the end of the day, it's just some software. It's not like there's no broker dealer there. The SEC was trying to claim that wallet app was a broker because it was facilitating the buying and selling of crypto outside of the normal centralized exchange that everyone knows as Coinbase. Well, the judge threw that count out, which was great news because there's in no universe should software be considered a broker. He allowed, I think, the other 5 counts to kind of proceed. So the bar was really low because Coinbase had filed for this all to be dismissed. That's what this was over. The bar was really low for the for the SEC to win the motion to kind of continue this case on most of the counts. And they won, the majority of probably what they care about. They would have loved that software piece to be in it. That would have really changed the industry and would have been pretty scary. But had the judge left it in now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're guilty or anything's wrong with it. It just would. It needs to kind of, move and kind of do its normal course through the court system. So
yeah, the court system. Yeah. As you think about what Coinbase position in the industry was prior to, FTX going away and blowing up, and a lot of the, Binance. How do you look at them in the industry today relative to some of the other major firms that maybe aren't in crypto today if you look at firms, they are doing crypto projects, they're doing things in the background, like firms like BlackRock clearly have products now, but how does Coinbase stack up as an organization in terms of its importance to the industry?
I mean, following the Binance piece getting cleaned up last fall, Coinbase is more important. They've soaked up some of those volumes that were left out of Binance. If you rewind all the way back to December of 2020, on the 23rd is when the case against Ripple was filed, made public. Within, I think, 2 weeks, early mid-January, like Coinbase and all the other US exchanges outside of Uphold had come along and said, "Oh, we're delisting XRP. We don't want to get in trouble with the XRP. With the SEC." You fast forward to anything that happens these days, the industry's like, now the SEC's got a reputation, right? That they're trying to shake people down effectively. And the industry stands up and like, no, no, thank you. We're going to push back. It's a totally different thing. And I think it's in a much healthier spot. It's a shame that it's having to go through it, but you know, it's, I've seen Coinbase almost do a 180. They used to like bend over backwards because in when that case was originally filed against Ripple, they were likely working on the application for their S1 to go public. So they were going to do nothing to piss off the SEC and almost kind of do whatever they wanted for that matter. You fast forward now, and now they're actually fighting over that same S1 about doing stuff in it that they told them originally. And now the SEC is saying that they shouldn't have been doing it. So that's a whole nother conversation, but it's a, it's an industry that's learned to fight. You see people rallying. I mean, you even see parts of crypto. There's a super PAC that was put together for political donations. It had three or four companies come together. Ripple was part of it. I think Coinbase was another one, big one in there, where they raised $75 million to contribute and help promote people that are running in different districts and for Senate and House representatives that are crypto forward to kind of, or, and in some cases to help get out some of the negative crypto people in Congress. Elizabeth Warren, you know, probably numero uno on that list. So.
The industry certainly wants to get back to having constructive dialogue on Capitol Hill with respect to regulation. It feels like all these ETFs have taken up a lot of the, you know, the conversation, and there's other things. Now we're in an election year. I don't know if anything happens, but it felt like there was a big push when FTX charges were first announced. And now it feels like, you know, we're in this state where maybe there's a lot of things happening behind closed doors, but you know, retail investors are now able to, you know, if they want to buy Bitcoin ETFs, they can. I don't know that the SEC was super excited that those approvals happened, but it certainly happened quickly. And it'll be interesting to see what the next year or two look like with respect to regulation.
Yeah, I'm just trying to review some quick notes here, because I have, in the last week or two, I read a small little piece, I'm not going to find it here quick enough, about how apparently some progress has been made, likely behind the scenes, or not as much out in the open.
Yeah,
about, some stablecoin regulation. That's certainly likely to be the first thing that comes along. Does it get passed this year? I don't know. I can't imagine Congress does much of anything meaningful, unfortunately. So, you know, admittedly, like, this election, I think, is pivotal for a lot of different reasons, depending on who you talk to outside of crypto. But just from a crypto lens, it is super important that we get a different administration and a different SEC chair, and hopefully can then Congress can somehow come together and pass some legislation.
What are you looking for over the next week? I know we're not through the end of this week, but I'm curious, like, over the next 5 to 7 trading days, like, what are the things that you're like catching your attention?
You know, for me, it's continued watching the Bitcoin ETFs, is kind of, you know, because more so as I am, it's almost like reality TV for me at this point. I'm enjoying the nature of the wowness of it. And, you know, just the idea of tokenization continues to pop up, real world asset tokenization more specifically, continues to pop up in conversations that I would have never expected. You're starting to see it. The OCC, which is the the organization that deals with banking stuff.
Right. Office of the Comptroller of the Currency.
Yes. I haven't watched it yet, but I've got a link to a video that where they were talking about tokenization. I'm like, okay, I would have not guessed it popped up in that, but like, it could have just been an anecdote somebody was talking about. So I've got some work to do, but just continue that tokenization to me is the next major trend that's going to happen in crypto, at least major narrative, over the next year or two. So
yeah. Interesting. Well, more news to come, I would imagine, on that front over the next several quarters, which we'll certainly break down here on the weekly crypto check-in.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, it's good seeing you, and we'll see everybody next week.
Take care.
Take care.